I wanted to start with a few examples of equanimity in my own life and in other people's lives. And because I'm sitting here in the role of teacher, it's just a role, I thought I'd give the example that was the only time I really ever learnt to be a teacher, a Dharma teacher, was in California. When maybe it was Jack, or I forget, said, to be a Dharma teacher is not about giving the most charismatic, wonderful talk you ever gave, but it's if you give the worst talk you ever gave in your life, you get up from the stage and you have no more thought about it. That seems like an excellent description of equanimity. And I mean, it 1,000 times a day, in a way, experiences for all of us come and we react. And in my case, there are many, many examples. I remember I like to go running sometimes, and I was running in Klil and fell over a rock. And I found myself, boom, on the ground. And as I was on the ground, I saw a tiny little flower that was hiding between two stones, but I would never have seen it before otherwise. And I was looking at that. And something similar happened to me many, many years ago when I was in Tel Aviv and I was crossing Rehov Dizengoff on the green man, you know, everything was as a pedestrian, and a crazy cyclist came against the red light and knocked me over, and I was lying on the asphalt, and there were cars going on the other side, and he stood above me and started to scream with anger at me. I was lying down there. And I looked at him and I just burst out laughing at this amazing, the way his mind twisted, you know. I could see the way his mind was working. He had to shout at me and it was just like so crazy and absurd. The story of the little plant is very much similar to a very dramatic example in the Zen tradition of a practitioner that's running, and he falls off a cliff, a tsuk, and down, and he will die. It's high up, and he falls off, but he manages to catch hold of a branch that saves him, and he's hanging there above the big drop. And the branch begins to come out of the earth. And then he sees next to him a strawberry growing, a tutsadeh, a beautiful one. Ah, and he picks the strawberry and eats it. It's like another calculation of life, which is, you know, the Buddhist teachings are very extreme about this. The stories of equanimity in the Buddhist teaching are very extreme, but not only the Buddhist teaching of 2,500 years ago. The story of the famous story of Chinese general, I think it's Chinese, who passes by a monastery and wants to go in for the night, and he knocks on the door, and the monk opens the door and says, sorry, we can't accept you now. This is not the right time. He says, what? Do you know who I am? I'm General big army officer. I can cut you in two pieces without blinking an eyelid. And the monk said, do you know who I am? I am the monk so-and-so, and I can be cut into two pieces without blinking an eyelid. They're extreme stories, but they're not so far away. A Tibetan teacher, who was also the doctor of the Dalai Lama, was imprisoned in Tibet by the Chinese, and he was tortured for many, many, many years, all the time. And he toured England, and he brought with him the instruments that the Chinese used to torture him, and he gave talks all over. And he was asked, "So, how was your practice? Well, did you lose practice in such a situation?" He said, "Yes, there were certain times when I lost compassion for the person torturing me, and at those moments I felt I lost my practice." Wow. So it's not just stories from, what is common about these stories? What is similar about them, all of them? Firstly, it is about engagement with life. None of them are stories of disconnection, of being shut down, of withdrawing from life and five-star hotel, shut the door. They're all right in the middle of life, but they all show a sense of independence, autonomy, readiness for anything to happen. And no constructions, no building stories. No building stories of the victim, of it should be different, of oy vey, this is really terrible, I wish it was something else. When is it going to stop? Why do I get myself in this, etc.? The stories we build around. So if we think it's so human that we do that, it's almost impossible not to do it, because they happen so fast. A fear comes in the heart. It happens very fast. The siren in Tel Aviv, actually the sirens where we are, the Pikud HaOref, it says you have 20 seconds, Esrim Shniot, to get into a safe space. On my telephone, Esrim Shniot. So it's completely impossible anyway. But never mind. But if the siren rings, the siren rings, who doesn't have thoughts about it? Yes, you go to the safe space, you go to the Cheder Mugan, but of course we have thinking, we have reactions. Oh, am I going to get there in time? Who's there with me? Or who's outside? It's of course, I'm not talking about something not human here. We build story, but there is a way in which we can really reduce the amount of construction we have around our emotions. We can reduce it dramatically, and we can just not go into that track habit of building story, narrative, because it's the narrative that controls us, not the fear, even the anger. Anger, fear, even moments of reactivity, of violence, but they come and they go. And the constructions we make around them don't go. We build a self around that. In the Buddhist language, bhava, self-construction. We build ourselves, not from the emotion, but from what we build around the emotion. And a lot of suffering in these days that we all feel around us and inside us, and especially people around us, is because of carrying, for example, fear turning to worry. They're not the same. And I don't want to go into it, but for sure a parent whose son is fighting in Gaza is going to experience fear, of course. But does it need to be 24 hours worry and the parent's life being basically destroyed in that time by worry? It's a question. And maybe the son who's fighting in Gaza would say, the most important thing I want you to do, Abba or Imma, is not to ruin your life by not sleeping at night and not destroying your life because of me. But fear is natural. Yes, I'm really afraid that something will happen to my son. Yes, for sure. Any of us, all of us, me too, of course. So we have to understand the difference between the two. The difference between the honest feeling of feelings that come, which is biological, organic, natural, and then the constructions out on that. So what is it that helps us not to build the constructions? It's basically, I know this is a big word, emptiness. I'm sorry to throw a word like that into the hall here. But it is important, and we've all mentioned it. Delia and David have mentioned it already, and it's certainly part of our practice that you know. And it's needed because life is totally unstable. It's not just today, and it's not just the sirens. There isn't any time where life is different. Life is unstable. Life is insecure. We are vulnerable beings. The Buddha said there is no final answer to fear. There's no safety in the end. No real safety for living beings except enlightenment and emptiness. Because it's so fundamental and life is so insecure. So it's not 2 years ago, it was a tiny virus that nobody could see that made the whole planet in absolute panic for 2 or 3 years. An invisible virus, which is just nature saying, who do you think you are? Human beings. And our problem is that we live in the illusion that we need to control. And we need to stop that sense of vulnerability. And most of the busyness of people is around stopping the sense of vulnerability, hapgiut, because we don't want to know about it. It's a price we pay. Trying to reduce the risk, the insecurity, and often the whole of life can be devoted to that. And at the end of our life, we feel we haven't lived. Because we're spending our whole life trying to close up possibilities of risk and vulnerability, trying to shut down vulnerability by super busyness or trying to get a milliardim of dollarim or whatever. So with that in mind, we still need to protect ourselves. There is no problem with that. The Buddha had a doctor. The Buddha didn't say, I'd be totally equanimous. Don't need a doctor. Don't need anything. No, he had his lunch in the middle of the day. He went off to the villages, collected food. He had his doctor. Like everybody, it's fine. It's respectful to the body, to look after the body. But what are we doing? How much do we invest in protection? There is an image from the I think it's Sufi tradition that there's three forms of protection. One is to be like a basket, which is blown by the wind, but always stays whole, which is similar to the form of protection I mentioned before, Taoism, that you bend and you're protected because you're bending, because you're dancing, because you're free and light, and you can't be destroyed. There's a lightness to fit yourself in situations and not to stand against situations by insecurity. Another form of protection is the rock, indeed. There's an image of the rock sitting, and this is also the eye of the storm image. To find our place, to find steadiness, to let the water go past, to be a rock in our place. It's helpful to be steady in the middle of things, to stand firm in our place. We're doing it here. We sit 45 minutes sitting in our place. There's something steady in that. But the third image is the image of, in this Sufi tradition, is the image of the glass, hashukhit, or transparent, to be transparent, to be shakuf. In other words, things pass through, but they don't stick, and they don't work, and they don't get stuck. Difficulty passes through us. We don't stop it. It's not the rock, but it passes through us and it doesn't destroy us. And that's the emptiness. That's the side of emptiness. And the most famous story of that, I think you probably know, is the empty boat. A passenger comes to, a person comes to a river. He wants to cross. And there's a boat with a boat. He says, "Can you take me across?" The boatman says, "Sure." He gets on the boat. The boatman starts to row. In the middle of the river, another boat comes full of people and hits this boat. And the boatman shouts, "You idiots, look where you're going. Why you knocked my boat?" They go on a bit and another boat hits this one, but an empty boat. And the boatman didn't say anything. The passenger said, "Why you didn't shout at the boat? You shouted at the other one." The boatman said, "There's no one to shout at." And the point of it is, if we are empty, there's nobody to shout at. Nobody will shout at us if we're empty. There's no one to shout at. Our practice that we are already practicing here, and I think Odelia gave some guidance this morning, works in that direction. It's basic to the Vipassana tradition, to the insight tradition. We do need to acknowledge our vulnerability, our basic vulnerability as a truth that frees us, and not a threat or a problem that we have to control or stop. As much as we are against vulnerability and trying to avoid it and stop it, we've got problems. But if we allow vulnerability, we allow our fragility, our shavri root, we know it deeply in us, life changes. There's a certain freedom that we'll feel, that vulnerability, pigiut, is not an enemy. It's the truth of things. And that we can reshift our life and live differently from that place. And it's not us. It's life is like that. Life is unstable. And so we can live with a deeper freedom of knowing that life is like that. And now I live. Now I live freely, not spending my whole life trying to shut down vulnerability. And it helps us to really to dance with uncertainty. to dance with uncertainty, with vulnerability. Dukkha, that's dukkha. And anicca, it's really a key to equanimity. Because we can see the way that we are influenced by conditions that are changing all the time. And that we can see that our experience is constructed by conditions that are not in our hands and we're not in control of, but our experience is made through conditions that happen to us all the time. And every moment we are picking up conditions and they're creating our inner experience. And then the conditions change in 1 second and our inner experience changes. In every second, now I'm talking, in every second, and even pieces of a second, everything is changing. The word that was has gone. The word that will come hasn't. The mind, our minds listening, my mind talking, is all the time fresh and new and creating another moment. This moment has never happened before, and again, and again, and again. It's just the anicca, the sense of flow, is really freeing us. And everything flows by. And we see it, we allow it, we see the change that's happening. We see everything is fresh and new. We see the Rishoniyu, the beginningness of everything, the original moment that's never happened before. And it really, we really live in a different way. And it helps us, for example, to be open to life. And even if emotions come that are difficult, they too are flowing. And they too invite us back into life again. Emotions are not a problem. They're life. Fear is not a problem. It's life. And if we see the way fear or anger or other emotions are like rivers of experience that changes and flows and opens and invites us to live. I think that's one of the beauties of Etty Hillerson's diary that also Adelia mentioned the other day, that when she's experiencing difficult emotions, a lot of pain, but she says, and again in different ways, when I'm close to pain, it opens me to the sky above and to the great mother of life and to the world. And I feel back into the richness of life. So through the emotions, which are natural and flowing and changing, but through anything, through thought, through our senses, we find ourselves in this stream of life. And it just helps us to be equanimous, to be ready to live, to be ready for what's happening, to be ready, to be open, to be in the stream, to let the stream pass through us without trying to stop it and trying to fix it and trying to control it. And so from there is a powerful source of equanimity, of standing in the middle of our life as it streams through us. And the third of the three characteristics, anatta, is just having more space, to be more spacious, to have more space inside in our experience, to be less contracted around a view, a thought, a reaction, a narrative, a story, or ourselves building things. It's more spacious. Emptiness is basically spaciousness, to have space in the consciousness, where we feel present, open, and not stuck inside constructions. And it goes very far, like the story of the empty boat. It goes pretty far. If we are more empty, it's not that we are more in a kind of minus or a kind of a zero place, FS place, nowhere place. We are empty of the self story. And instead of that, we have the world story that is living itself through us. The world is looking out of our eyes. And you can see how that can really help us feel protected. Because if we and the world are connected, because we're more empty of me and the world, me facing the world, me against the world, me protecting myself from the world, this duality, this friction, chikuch, me with the world, then who's hurting whom? Who can be disturbed? Who can disturb who? Where's the disturbance coming from? If you are the world, then who can what can disturb what? You're already in the world, so where's disturbance can happen? It goes to that place where the world can't hurt you because you are the world. So it goes very far, and we can actually practice it. We can actually practice in that place. If we see our consciousness like the sky, our awareness is like the sky. It's knowing that has no limits. Then the clouds can't disturb the sky. The thoughts can't disturb the consciousness. And it's not so mystical, and the Buddha kept talking about it. Let your meditation be like the earth, he said. Let your meditation be like the sky. Because then you can't be hurt or can't be disturbed. A thought can't disturb consciousness because consciousness is limitless, like the sky. Can take it all. The sky isn't disturbed by thought. I did say this to a group the other day. About talking to one of my grandchildren about what she thought of what's going on in the world. And she said, "It'll be okay. I'm happy." I said, "Yeah, tell me more." She said, "Life is bigger than us. Life will be fine. We may not be fine, but life knows what to do. I trust life. Maybe we'll finish ourselves like the dinosaurs finish themselves, possible, but life will carry on, and that makes me happy." So if a young girl can say that, teenager, you know, we can also go there and see that place of life point of view and less of a personal point of view. And that's anatta. And we take it as far as we can. And I do recommend, by the way, Basograim, I recommend when you're practicing here or at home, do remember to have give some interest to a ground of consciousness. It's like the sources of our thought, where our thought is arising from. It's from an unlimited empty space of awareness. And that place cannot be hurt, disturbed. And if we can even touch it a little bit in our daily practice, things happen. In the a word that's relevant to equanimity here, which is not usually connected in the Buddhist tradition, is ariya. And you've heard of noble silence or noble eightfold path. And the word ariya is a Sanskrit word meaning to become noble. But the noble eightfold path, it's not the path that's noble. It's the path that makes us noble. Noble silence is not the silence it's noble, it's the silence that makes us noble. And there is something in the equanimity which I think is noble. I know noble's got sort of all kinds of meanings as well, aristocratic and so on, and never mind. But there's something there that it helps us to be noble in life, meaning steady and ready and big person. And it's the noble truths, the basic Buddhist teaching that does it. And it's anicca, anatta, non-attachment. It's right there in the heart of the practice. Equanimity is impersonal in other ways too. As one of the Brahma Viharas, that means metta, karuna, mudita, and upekkhas, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, or joy with the joy of others, and equanimity, upekkha. They are movements beyond the self. In their tradition, they are called immeasurable. They cannot be measured with the mind. They are not there in the mind. They're not the territory of thought. The way they are taught in the suttas is as a vibration, tether universale, almost a vibration which is endless. The Buddha talked about spreading the vibration of kai, of metta, to the whole universe, spreading the vibration of compassion, spreading the vibration of equanimity and of joy. They're not personal, and they're all limitless. They're beyond the limits. And so equanimity has that quality of being limitless, of something that isn't inside the usual mental structure. I have to add one more thing about it. It's important to see the difference between equanimity and indifference, adishut. They can be very close. It's very easy to get them mixed, and sometimes we can't help it because they can be very close that we feel, and sometimes it's totally right to be, like I said yesterday, in the eye of the storm, to shut out the storm. I'm not saying it's a problem, but it's good to know the difference between shutting out disturbance and allowing disturbance to get in, but not destroy us. I mean, it's good to know the difference. I've got a quote here from T.S. Eliot. There are three conditions which often look alike, yet differ completely, though they grow in the same hedgerow, gader chai. Attachment to self and to things and to persons. Detachment, which is basically equanimity, detachment from self and from things and from persons, and growing between them, indifference, adishut. It resembles the others as death resembles life. It's a very beautiful line. It seems indifference, adishut, seems to be like equanimity, but it's as different as death and life, although they are so connected together. So, finally, to give some other language to equanimity, its relationship instead of resistance. It's about being in relationship by being with everything, including experiences that are difficult. It's being in intimacy with everything that life offers to us. As we move out from a self point of view into a world point of view or life point of view, we take that point of view of life. We are finding ourselves more protected, less resistance. We're right in the middle of life. We let go, we surrender, and we find ourselves right there in the center of everything. And we realize it's really the only place to live. And equanimity is it's always the highest, given as the highest quality that we develop in the Buddhist path. It's at the end of the last one of the 10 paramis, the last one of the bhojangas, the 7 factors of awakening, when you go through all of them. They're not linear, all of these, but anyway, it's still the last one. Because, and here's a quote from the Buddha, because the Buddha said, when they've been practicing, in the end, all that's left is equanimity. If you practice, all that's left in terms of your experience is equanimity. There remains only equanimity, now quoting from the Pali text. It's purified, it's bright, it's flexible, workable, it's shining. And just like a skilled goldsmith will take some gold, will prepare the fire, will heat it and put in the gold, and time to time it will burn, and time to time he will blow on it, and time to time he'll sprinkle it with water, and from time to time we'll just look at it, and the gold will be refined and will be rid of all its impurities, and will be workable and will be shining, and it can make a necklace And you can make anything out of it. So that remains equanimity. In the end, you can make everything out of it. Okay, and I think I'll stop there. So we'll take a few minutes of quiet.